Welcome to the 2017 Bay Area Book Festival. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the festival. Enjoy the conversation.
Good afternoon. Welcome. Can you hear me okay? My name's Elizabeth Rosner, and you are on flight 4992. No, you're at a session called Fiction at the Edges. I hope that's where you wanted to be and expected to be. And I'm here with Chris Lee, and you're going to hear all sorts of things about her and from her. I would like to first acknowledge the sponsor of this session. So I'm here to tell you that we are sponsored by the Literature Translation Institute of Korea. It's kind of cool. Have you ever heard of them? Now you know. So some of you may know that this originally was scheduled to be a panel. There were meant to be three of us here. Per Pedersen from Norway was going to be here, and unfortunately he was unable to make it. So hold a good thought for him. I'm sure he's fine, but he couldn't make it. And if you haven't read his work, I encourage you to do so. Out Stealing Horses was the book that I think really launched his global renown, but his newer book is called I Refuse, and I highly recommend them both. They're gorgeous, compelling works of art, and so I want to acknowledge his invisible presence here today, too. Before we begin, I just want to quickly ask for a show of hands, if you don't mind. How many of you already know Chris Lee's work, either from her story collection previously, or this new book, How I Became a North Korean? Hands? Wow, okay, you're about to get some new fans. So I'm thrilled that you're all here. And what I've done is asked Chris if she'd be willing to read an excerpt first from the book so you can hear the sound of her voice on the page. But one of the beauties of a book festival is that when you walk away and take the book home with you, you get to carry that sound with you. And so now you'll be able to read the book knowing Chris's actual voice. So thank you for reading to us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here as well, too, to the festival. So I'm going to read from my novel, How I Became a North Korean, just a short excerpt from it to give you a sense of the beginning of the novel's trajectory. It's a novel that I guess Michael Silverblatt's on Bookworm called a political novel, and first made me realize what this might be, because when I work on a book, I don't think of what it is, but more how to enter that world. And there's three main characters in the first person point of view, and I'll read from one of them at the beginning of the novel when she is crossing from North Korea into the Chinese border area. In late February or early March, I walked across the frozen Tumen River toward a man from China, ready to give my unborn child a different life. Of course, my crossing had actually started much earlier, maybe with a great hunger or even before I was born. The China beyond the river that day was as dried up and as brown as my country. I walked with the eyes of men and women following me from both sides of the shore. I remember being hopeful through that the riverbanks were still hoary with the remaining snow. A border patrol who the man from China had bribed followed me across. There were broad, dark patches where the ice looked as thin as glass, but I was from a border town. I'd smuggled goods in and out since I was 14 and knew how to read the river. I looped around where the ice became dangerously clear until I was standing in the center of the frozen river and facing the man from China, a Chosonjok, so he spoke our language. He had an eager smile and a small head. He was small everywhere, it seemed. And he limped slowly forward as if needing my permission to come closer. With every step, his left leg swung out rigidly in a semicircle until we faced each other. He was nervous. His right foot kept making circles on the ice behind him like a ballerina. This man named Songshik said, "You really do believe me now, don't you? I'm a person who can make these kinds of meetings happen. I know everyone and everyone knows me. Money? Who needs money? You need connections." He tore skin from his lower lip with his teeth. He wanted my approval. The way he repeated himself made that clear. But we didn't have much time, so I interrupted him. "I learn fast," I said. "I'll learn anything you want." I shut my eyes tight so I wouldn't have to look at him. When I opened them, he was still shyly taking me in. The shy ones were the worst, hard to read. "Why do you want to leave?" he asked, as if half my country, the country of his ancestors, didn't dream of living differently. I was so nervous that my fingers dug arcs into my palms. "There are no good men in my country." He brightened as I'd intended. "I'm a good man, I promise." While the border guard smoked an imported cigarette from the many cases I'd given him to keep him happy, the Choson man and I hurried through the 10 minutes of time we had to talk, the courting time that he had bought for us. Money was a symbol, a disease that infected our country. It was all the money I had earned after quitting school during the Great Hunger, my life savings, you could call it. I was 8 when the famine changed everything. After the government ration stopped and the crops were flooded and destroyed year after year, my Omma made several trips into China's border towns to find work and food to feed us. Our government had disappeared, and everyone who had followed the rules, including my appa, died. I didn't follow rules. I stole and bartered and learned quickly, and I survived. But when the government devalued our money and made our savings worthless, all my work became nothing at all. There was no present, and the future looked even worse. Then my monthly bleeding stopped, and I realized I was pregnant. After that brief meeting, I continued talking with a Choson stranger on a Chinese telecom wire cellular phone that I used to smuggle goods between the two countries. I delayed making decisions while I continued to work and earn yuan. Foreign currency was the only kind I trusted anymore. The same dust clouds blew behind me as I walked to the Chinese border. It opened its large mouth to receive and release dried fish, iron ore, pine mushrooms, and other goods that we floated over in plastic sacks to our Chinese partners across the Tumen River after paying our bribe. Unless we were pretty and poor, then we could pay with our bodies. I stared across the narrow bend of river at the cars and the blue and red tiled roofs bright in the sun and imagined who, on the other side, I might become. There was no dream possible on our side of the river, and a child with only a mother would be a second-class citizen. But I didn't rush and made contact with a broker trolling our border towns for prospective brides to marry unwed Chinese men. This woman with leathery hands approached me at the market, then quickly pulled me away so that we could talk in private and in out of danger. I'm going to skip down to when she starts the crossing. After the broker that the Choson man had hired bribed a chain of local officials, after I bribed still others to register me dead of tuberculosis to protect my umma, I left while she was sleeping. It was safer for her not to know much. I packed the essentials, nothing personal, and passed the village walls without looking back. I believed I was good at not looking back. Maybe it was 2 or 4 in the morning when I finally crossed, but all the hours feel the same when you're terrified and ready to end your life if caught. Against the mountain peaks rising like dull knives, the moon stalked our half-naked group wading across the shallow river. The moonlight made us as translucent as ghosts. It was as if we were shedding our very selves to become someone else. "It'll hurt," the broker leading us out had warned. Hurt wasn't the right word for crossing in early spring. Pain needled up my legs. I blew out white clouds too thick, too visible. I tried to stop breathing. Halfway across, I heard what sounded like a gun. We dropped deep into the water, and my hands rose up to beat away a bullet that never came. Like the thousands before me since the famine, I shadowed the broker's exact watery steps to avoid the man traps along the shore and the gaze of China's cameras. I could only ask myself, why didn't I cross before the river's sudden thaw? Finally, shivering, colder than I have ever been, I dragged myself up the muddy bank and kneaded my numb toes and fingers. When I found them still there, I felt light, almost happy. I looked for the man who would be my husband for now. His thin arms, his chestnut brown face, anything to reduce the scale of that country suddenly too large for me.
Thank you. Stunning. Among many other things we're going to talk about is language, because Chris Lee has written poetry and short fiction and now long fiction. And as I was listening, I was listening to the thematic repetition of certain words, the word crossing, the word border, the word hunger, and then this notion of a self kind of dissolving to make way for a new self that was going to emerge on the other side. And those are some of the themes that run through the book, and I'm thinking about how the parallel with the writer in person, again, one of the advantages of attending a book festival is that you get to find out some things about the writer behind the book. And many writers are very private and very introverted, and yet they make this leap onto a stage in a way. This isn't exactly a stage, but you know what I mean. And so I want to ask you how many of those images feel like part of what you're doing as a writer, this crossing the borders, the self becoming visible in a different way.
I'd say both as a writer and as a person, these are things that happen for me in the process of writing a book. It's the more I write, the longer I write, the less I think there's a division between the life that one lives and the writing that one does. When I first began writing, and I wasn't thinking I was going to finish a book or actually publish, but writing because I needed to write and I loved what language did, the material of language, I thought, I live my daily life and then I enter a book and I write. And I realized that the way one writes now and the way one lives often mirrors each other. And so the crossing that I have done from Korea to America to England, and then back to Korea, or the selves that I left America in some ways to escape what my life was like here, and you think you're starting over again, and you bring those old selves back, and I saw. Many of my closest friends are North Koreans, and I worked as an activist in that world. And I saw them again chasing new selves, desiring new identities. But as we all know, we are a history of selves, and we carry all those selves inside us. But writing itself, again, is that border in some ways, something magical that you enter, where I think language... Sometimes we have these people around us and family and people you love, and something Lori Moore once wrote was how it's more difficult to understand a single hello from a human being than it it's more complex than all of the natural phenomena around us, and I think writing for me in a way is trying to communicate that which is most difficult to communicate. And some of the themes that you picked up on from that passage were things that I've been probably obsessed with all my life and creating in my own life, only to realize that that's the same thing you do as a fiction writer every time.
So just to say about the structure of the book, and so that character that Chris read from is one of three different individuals who all share the narrative. They take turns telling the story, and they take turns narrating their own journeys to cross out of North Korea. And their lives intersect in a variety of ways. Their stories intersect, again, thematically, literally, and metaphorically. And as you gathered, that particular character is pregnant and is trying to find someone who will unwittingly be willing to claim that he's the father of the child. And so her narrative is especially complicated because of her body being also a significant part of her transformation. And so I wanted to ask you about that too. Just it was something that I noticed in Per Pedersen's work also, the way that the fictional versions of trauma have to be so deeply embodied, and how that carries the message to the audience that we are. I was just listening to part of the panel that Roxane Gay was on, and it was all about women writing the body. And so I'm really struck by your use of a pregnant woman as one of the characters. And can you say something about that?
In terms of both the body itself and then trauma, Changmi, the character who I had read from, was inspired. She's not based on anyone I know, but she was inspired by many women I knew and still know. Especially, I worked in a small NGO in South Korea, and one of the projects was with single mothers. Some of these women who enter relationships do so willingly, you would think, in some ways, except it's not really out of choice. It's almost like a bondage contract, in a way to get out, a way to get some modicum of you can call it freedom, I suppose. Often there's more kidnappings that happen directly at the border area. They now have like these, you know, they hide out in hunts, these brokers, other brokers who resell women, and they have dogs to sniff out people when they're crossing in the dark. And so I saw so many of these women who trauma has affected them on a absolutely cellular level. They do sometimes terrible things. They hurt everyone around them that they love or maybe don't love in some cases. And particularly a man that I helped get out of the country. I was set up a safe house for in China, and he begged me to get him out. And he ended up in a relationship in South Korea with a woman who was a single mother, desperate for somebody who was going to take care of her child and herself in Korea, South Korea, and in safety. And yet she was trying to get help anywhere she could. And so he didn't realize, but she was also keeping up a relationship with her Chinese lover, the father of the child, and trying to bring him over, but really using him as a bank account in some ways. And we can judge this until you understand what this survival instinct is, what drives these people, and they might be physically intact, but emotionally they are not. And many of them do things that later, when they are more whole, haunt them. They sometimes things, unspeakable things that leave them unable to sleep.
I think that's such an important, again, theme in the book, is this question of what people do under desperate circumstances and the level of morality, in a way, isn't a set of decisions. That's almost set off to the side. It really is a question of the decisions one makes on the basis of survival, and the recognition that the rules, you use the word rules also in that passage that you read, you know, the rules change at the border. I'm also thinking about the way that each of these three characters has to make these compromises, but you humanize them so beautifully that we don't judge. I mean, you also set your moral code aside as you recognize what these characters are struggling with. So I'm thinking about the self-love required as a writer to do that, to write characters who are other or can be seen as other. And you said earlier that you needed to write. Can you say something about that?
First, the idea of other, writing has taught me, because I always thought, you know, even with my first, my story collection, Drifting House, because I didn't want to write about me. I actually probably started writing in some ways because I didn't want to be me for many reasons. I started reading to escape myself and my life. And so I thought I was writing the other in some ways, but by writing the other, you realize you are writing so much of yourself and you're writing so much of your life. And even though the characters are, you know, they're in this book, they're North Korean. It's obviously a community I know well. I've known for more than 10 years very closely, many who we call each other brother and sisters, a surrogate family in a way. And yet, by writing their story in the loosest sense, I realized how much of me and how much of my own obsessions in some ways was an experience in the book that I only realized later. It's not apparent when you're writing. Writing is so hard, as we both know, that you only see the your own patterns much later, when it's basically almost too late to do anything about it. With my first book, after I finished it, I realized I was like, I'm so exposed now. And there's no story in there, except for maybe one, that is directly directly autobiographical, really. And yet, it was so much of me that it, as I said to the CBS News anchor I had an interview with, I said, it's like walking into a cocktail party, but you're the only one wearing a bikini. Yeah.
Another image theme that repeats is hiding, and the idea that in theory authors who write fiction are hiding behind their characters, and yet readers, I think, because I also read as well as write, we're constantly trying to look behind the character to find the author. So it's such a paradox, that game, in a way, we play. And my first novel also had three alternating narrators, and I remember one of my colleagues saying, well, which one is you? And then he paused, and we kind of exchanged a look, and he said, all of them? You know, and you know, so there's something in a way profoundly narcissistic about it, even though we actually feel like we're trying to be self-effacing. But I think it's that profound curiosity, right, to both escape and find yourself. So I want to go
and find the world too.
Yeah. So the world, that your world is very global, right? You're living in South Korea, but you're writing there in English, which I find really hard to imagine. So can you talk about what that's like using, you know, this foreign language? That is in your imagination, not in your reality.
I'm switching languages is switching cultures, and then, of course, literally being in another culture is, it's disorienting but exciting, I think. I mean, that's another kind of edge in a way. I started, of course, as I've kind of given a loose trajectory, but a few years ago, I won a prize that brought me to Rome for 1 year. I had thought I was going to live in England for the rest of my life when I was there, and of course I didn't. I left and went to Korea, and having lived on three continents was first in some ways disorienting, because this desire to belong somewhere or to have a home, to be oriented. I really did feel it on in a way that was, I think, a childhood calling. We moved every 3 years, so this disorientation was a part of life. But I realized what it is. I mean, if we come back to the idea of edge, is that it allows to be at the edge allows you to see what is beyond there in some ways, and to be a kind of drifting house, to be permanently disoriented or destabilized or moving between cultural values. I was in Italy a week ago because my book just came out in Italy again. And even when we think of Europe, each country is so different. And the language and the culture, the access to that, I find really exciting. So being in Korea, speaking in Korean, my partner's Korean, he doesn't speak English. And yet many of my friends are both Korean and international there. And then to write in a language, Korean is an incredible language, and I translate from Korean to English. My first book I translate is coming out this summer. But to write, I have to go back to English for myself, because that's the private language. It's the poetry I started with. It's a language that has more adjectives and adverbs and borrowed words than any other language in the world. And if anyone has a full edition of the OED, we know how many words are in there and growing. And that, all languages excite me, but the language that I studied in is the only language I can really imagine writing in. And it becomes even more of a private language because I'm in a culture where they don't speak it. So there's this public space I go out and I speak Korean and I'm in that world. And when I retreat, I'm really retreating to that corner where it's just me and words and a story that doesn't seem to have any relationship with what's around me, though it does, of course. And I like that privacy.
That's fascinating, the idea that you're writing in private for a public in a way. I mean, I'm guessing that you're not constantly thinking about your audience. You're really with your characters. But it is a kind of displacement, because displacement is of course, a lot of what this book is about. Leaving a place, finding a place, being uncomfortable in place, hiding in place. And then this question of, does salvation lie in a place? Can you reach a place where salvation will find you? So there's a religious component to this book too. Can you say something about that?
Yes, and I'm really glad that you mentioned that, because many people haven't, like the reviews that came out, they often don't talk about the religious component in the book. The activists within the North Korean refugee community are maybe about 98% Christian, and at the border area, definitely more fundamentalists. And I grew up in the church. I was a pastor's kid. Anyone with a Korean American background knows we're called PKs. And what I've realized is you can leave the church, but the church will never leave you. And so I'm obsessed with religion, because religion for me is both salvation in the like more metaphorical sense, whether people turn to faith or whether it's art or whether it's power or money, people look for a way to understand how to live. How do we carry out this journey? But when religion is not necessarily a guide for living in the way that Joseph Campbell talks about, but becomes something more about hierarchy and power and a social system like so many of our other systems, then it breaks down. And that's what you really see. That's what I'm really fascinated by. I'm fascinated by discomfort in a way. And that place of believing and yet being confronted with what faith does, and the role that Christianity plays in humanitarian movements around the world, is something I'm drawn to. Here in this book, of course, it happens at the border area. It's also in South Korea. But the refugee camps for Syrians as well, too. You have a very large missionary population working there as well. And each time the stories you hear are incredibly, they're surprising, but to actually see it is, I don't know, very disappointing. I mean, very shocking.
Yeah, so there's an agenda driving some of these salvation movements, as anyone who's really paying any kind of attention, I think, knows, just in terms of the proselytizing in general that goes on, but reaching out to an especially vulnerable population and then using them to further this agenda of dogma and conversion. And so it's a complex part of this book. I'm actually surprised that people don't talk about it more, because I think it's a really important, again, investigation of simply moving from point A to point B is not what refugees are doing, right? And the terminology of refugee, how it people kind of frequently interchange the word with immigrant, and it's so not an interchangeable term, and the stakes are completely different, and the price involved completely different. So I think you're asking some really hard questions about what does it cost to leave a country? What does it cost to go into exile?
Yes, and definitely the power structure that is a part of any refugee experience. You have absolutely no power, no choice, and so the people you meet who are there to either help, hurt you, or both have so much of that power. It reminds me of Toni Morrison's Nobel Prize speech with the blind woman being confronted by a group of kids, teenagers with a bird in their hands, they say, but she doesn't know whether that bird exists or not. And I've always been haunted by that image, because a bird is such a fragile thing in someone's hand. Anything can happen to that bird. And what my relationship with power has always been, well, why don't we let that bird go?
Yeah, and it sets up the tremendous potential for betrayal. You know, there. I won't tell you who betrays who in the book, of course, but but that level of vulnerability to those in power, and the requirement that you end up having to trust untrustworthy people because you really have no alternative. Your own agency is so restricted by your circumstances. So, you know, in your case, you said in an interview, I think it was with The Guardian, you said that you are protected by having a U.S. passport, and that you've actually been threatened in your own country, and you've been at risk. And so I don't know how many, I'm not going to ask people who are citizens in here, but I think this idea that the U.S. passport can actually protect you is an interesting question.
Citizenship is something, of course, any immigrant, anyone who has come from another country, has different cultures, or your parents came from somewhere else, is something you've thought of. But particularly when I started becoming friends with North Koreans, and then I started becoming active in that world, there was a time, even before my first book came out, where I considered going into the country and working in a way that I felt, okay, if I go to jail, if I get caught by the Chinese police and I go to jail, I knew that the U.S. citizenship, that passport, meant that someone from the embassy would come and visit me, check up on me once a week, and make sure I'm not being tortured and that I'm being fed. And I realized that because there were South Korean activists I knew who came back destroyed. They went from 90 kilograms to 43 bones. There were people who came back who had been declared dead twice because their heart had stopped while they were being tortured in jail. And the South Korean government it's a terrible thing to have the kind of power that the U.S. has. I mean, we see how in the era of Trump, the country has become a kind of global bully, unlike the will of the people. But the irony is that power is also what protects the activists. It gives them a modicum of protection. So I knew that. I, for my partner's sake, he did not want me to go to jail. And so at that point, I wasn't involved. But one other person who did go to jail for about 3 years asked me later to help set up a safe house in China because he couldn't go in anymore. Of course, he's not allowed to anymore. And I had I agreed because there was an emergency and people needed help. I later had a death threat against me by the humanitarian side, and this is the great irony, is when I helped someone escape who begged me. I mean, to have a grown man on his knees asking you for help is a terrible thing. I just said, you should not have to do that. We should be getting you out. And the resistance to getting him out had a lot to do with all sorts of things that that are in the book. But needless to say, of course, I'm always on the side of the right to life. And so I did help him escape on my own, despite the people that I was working with. And then later, there was, a death threat posted against me, and then gang members who were, they started to call me, they found out where I live, they had all this information about me, and so I got rid of that phone and went to the States and was here for about 4 or 5 months. And then when I came back, it was quiet.
I think for a lot of us, I know for me, it's almost impossible to imagine what it's like to live under that, except that maybe we don't have to imagine it so much anymore. It may actually be around the corner here, too. The idea that as a writer, you know, you were talking about that private space you enter when you're writing, and yet what is happening to you, as you said earlier, how you're living your life is intricately interwoven with how you write. So during that period of time, were you writing? Were you also writing?
Oh, no. I wasn't even thinking about writing. You know, there's so many things that, I'm kind of, we have how many years on this planet, and I try to do what I can, and I'm also just in love with the day or the moment and with all the multiple, lives and experiences that I feel like I've been very lucky to have, because my parents didn't have that. They didn't have that choice. But the things come back, I think, and then they end up affecting and changing your fiction. Or when you start to write, I discover what I want to write about and how I want to write about it in the actual writing. I'm not much of a planner when it comes to my books. I try to decide what I want to write about, and I try to have this, to try to make it easier for myself. And then I realize I have no control with the work, that the work needs to become the thing it's becoming, and it teaches me what it wants to be. And that's when the writing gets really exciting for me. It's also gets very messy. My third book, I wrote it completely out of chronology, and it was like a puzzle. And it meant I threw away 150 pages out of 200 from the beginning. But I realized in that way, I didn't know what it was about. I didn't know what order it would be in. And it showed me what it might become through that. And the very similar thing happened in this book, the chronology. I had imposed on it, and then it kept changing.
So, does the new book have a title yet?
No, it has several different possible titles, but there's two books I'm working on. One, a short story collection, and that one has a title, but the novel has several possibilities.
I'm wondering if anybody out there is already burning with a question. I know sometimes we save the Q&A for so late in the game that that there isn't enough time, so I just wanted to check in with you. Is anyone already, like, desperate to jump in? I know we have to get... Sorry, I know I'm, like, breaking a rule. Just messing with you. Up there in the back. Thanks. I'm using my power.
Can you hear me? Thank you. So I'm just curious, do you think about writing nonfiction Why fiction? I know you said it was a way of escaping. And do you still feel that way?
I sometimes write nonfiction for articles or anyone who commissions me to do something. And it makes me feel very insecure and uncomfortable. I mean, I did mention I like being uncomfortable. I realized this recently, actually. I thought, why is it that I like living in different countries and languages and speaking really elementary Italian? And there's something about discomfort that feels at home for me. Nonfiction is becoming very interesting to me, but only if I could write it in a way that, for example, to write what I experienced. This was something that my agent had wanted me to pursue because, of course, the memoir is a very big market. But if I cared about that, I wouldn't have started writing poetry and short fiction. And so that to write a story as it happens is not interesting for me because I already know it. And that's, for me, I'm writing towards the questions, the way that I suppose Chekhov has said that's what fiction does. But if I write nonfiction in longer form, I'm considering more writing something that weaves in, you know, ideas from the way it can bring time together and themes and the ancient past with the contemporary moment, and play with chronology to get at something with me as like a tiny postscript somewhere hiding in the nonfiction is much more interesting to me than to write my known world.
Thank you. Thanks for the question. There's another one in the front row. I'll jump back in too. And in fact, I want to comment on that before we get to your question, if you can wait just one sec. So, you know, a lot of people in publishing right now are really discussing this question in a way, and particularly on the subject of violence and trauma and the aftermath of violence and trauma and war, and what it is that fiction can do that nonfiction can't do, and vice versa. And so I think, just because I have my first book of nonfiction coming out this fall, having been a fiction writer, I'm really interested in that border and crossing it too. And what do you gain and what do you lose by doing that? And it's that, I think, is really actually part of a big literary conversation, including what are the rules of nonfiction anymore? How narrative can it be? What role does the imagination play in a nonfiction context? Do you want to say something?
And it just reminded me that the one of the most moving letters, I got a very long letter last year from a parliament member at Westminster, which was very exciting. And he had invited me to speak at Westminster, which I didn't end up being able to do because I teach in Seoul. But he had said that he worked on a human rights commission within Parliament, and he had read hundreds of reports and pages and memoirs and whatnot about North Korea. But he said that my book was the first one that actually made him care about the people, and that had been the real goal of the book, to really almost to go beyond the reason the title being, that's again the kind of border, that to identify someone sometimes as a citizenship or as a member of a nation rather than an individual is to forget that that behind the North Korean is actually so many infinite memories and people and spaces, and to read that first before you see the nation was really my goal, because North Korea especially is so, in some ways, glamorized. The trauma of North Korea is glamorized, and you forget that it's not very glamorous for the people who are experiencing it. So that the trauma of a nation, I think, is the thing that you can really make come to life in fiction in a very intimate form. So we go from inward outward rather than the converse.
Yeah, so the precise outlines of an individual experience get heightened in this way through fiction. The dimensionality of an individual rather than I mean, and not to disparage one form or the other, but those advantages are real in fiction.
Hi, I just wanted to kind of comment on your anecdote about how the novel that you're currently writing, you kind of wrote it out of order, and you kind of were heading towards a thing that you didn't quite know what that thing was. And I know that I do that all the time, and it's simultaneously freeing but also really frustrating, because when you don't know where you're working towards, it can be really hard to maintain momentum or to feel like you have a place that you're going towards. So can you kind of talk about how you are currently writing with this kind of free flowing structure and this availability about an endpoint? Because I think that would be really beneficial.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. In some ways, the way I started writing this third book was in recognition that it's much closer to my personality than anything more logical. I look, you know, I suppose relatively tidy. You know, I try to keep myself clean in public and shower, and, you know, the privilege of, I think about that sometimes, that the fact that we live in a time where we can actually shower every day, and we're living like royalty in the 19th century. You know, it's such a strange, we're surrounded by these strange privileges that we now take for granted. But I'm basically an incredibly chaotic person. My head is mud, and, you know, and so to write completely out of order and follow, I was trying to follow language. I wanted to be free from almost whatever is just conscious and the order and intentions that I might impose on a book, and to be excited by each moment that happens or each theme or idea that strikes me. So I'm trying to create, I mean, the poet in me is not, I don't like the maximalist novel so much. I mean, there's books that I enjoy, but I don't think I really want to write an 800-page book that keeps repeating itself in some ways rather than growing. I mean, not all of them do that, of course. But my inclination is I want something that has the capaciousness of a maximalist novel, the ambitions of that, but to be spare. And so I really was trying to follow words and follow ideas and follow the excitement of the moment for me, because I'm interested in anything from anthropology to, you know, post-humanism to, you know, computer technology to dystopian worlds to the caves, the underground caves where Christians were persecuted and hid out in Turkey, and infinite cultures and worlds. So, you know, this chaotic head, it's like, how do I put in everything I'm interested in of the moment into a book and yet not have it go on and somehow make it all work together? And so that's what I followed every moment I was sitting down to write, is the thing that was exciting me, and then finding out later, how is this connected? How is it telling me a story? And so throwing out everything that didn't belong and then starting again with the little that I had left, and then letting that, from there, creating a structure based on what the book was becoming. Yeah.
That's a great explanation. I want to add, too, that, you know, there's this kind of myth that coherence depends on linearity. And I think, you know, if you just pay attention to a single day of your life and what's going through your mind on that day, it's anything but linear. And yet there is a kind of coherence to it. And when I always write in fragments and in bursts, and there's some point after I've accumulated X number of pages where I ask myself some really hard questions about, you know, what stays and what goes. But it's also because that's when I need some architecture. But if the architecture comes too soon, I'm literally like shutting entire rooms out of my awareness. So I do a lot of mosaic building on my living room floor, you know, like moving chunks of prose around. And also, I heard Sean Penn once talking about the film 21 Grams. Do you remember that film? And he used this wonderful phrase. I don't know if it was the director's phrase or his own, but he said it had emotional linearity. And I loved that. And I really rely on that notion that our emotions move us in so many directions that we can trust that as a sense of coherence and truth. And it's not necessarily in any way alphabetical or sequential. So, yeah.
And it also depends on what kind of a writer you are. Some writers, like Alice Munro, I think mine a territory deeply, and that literally a geographical territory as well as an emotional territory. And other writers, sometimes the kind of writer I'm realizing I am is if I've written one thing, I want to try something else. Each time it has to be somehow new and different for me in terms of where it's taking me in form and place and genre. So because the second book was a political novel, it was realistic. You know, a dream that came to me was the seed of my third book, and it took place underground. It was a very surreal, strange image of a couple making love and getting dirt in their eyes and their nose and their mouth because they couldn't stand up. It was such a small space. It's becoming I suppose you can call it fantasy, sci-fi, literary, other in these prose poem-like bits, but it's, I don't know what it is. I never know what it is until it's done. And yet the desire is to do something new. And then you realize you are coming back to excavating similar places in some ways, but other ways as a writer, in terms of the form itself, you're discovering something. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that's the, right. What keeps you coming back, I think.
Other questions out there? Thanks, Mike Runner.
Yeah, sorry.
Okay.
Hi. Sorry, this question has sort of a weird preface. Because I know that this your story is about, or some of the themes are displacement and trauma and that dissolution of identity, and it made me think of a professor I had. She had studied West African genocide and continentalist philosophy, and her thesis, she was telling me, was centered around this observation that in post-genocidal fiction, a lot of the narrators weren't human but animals or non-humans, and it is centered around this idea that once in a sort of trauma that is and follows a genocidal conflict, the body and the self is completely destroyed, and you have to sort of, the way you reconnect is to go back to the animal or to the side of nature, and it made, like, your the themes that are being discussed here made me think of that. And so I was wondering if you had ever seen that in any of the collaborators or the other authors that you know who sort of come from this environment of trauma and displacement and loss of the self and the destruction of the self. Have you ever seen that where the way they narrate or the voices that they use come from a non-human source?
I can't think of anything offhand, especially in long form. I mean, I have actually written a very short story before about genocide, the genocide in Cambodia, from the point of view of the forest, of the jungle. And that, again, was... That intuitive choice that comes to you, you know, how does one tell the story? And then the first sentence happens. And actually maybe a similar move happens in my third novel, it looks like, as well, because as you say, the non-human, I suppose that narrating a story is able to look at something with dispassionately. and from and I suppose anthropologically these days the idea of the non-living the soul of the tree, for example, that those kinds of books are going back to that idea of what that non-human perspective looks like, which I think is really interesting, but I can't think of a longer form that sustains it.
Yeah, there's a lot of complexity in your question. I really appreciate it, because this idea that, again, speaking of borders and edges and crossings, and the idea that there is some kind of really distinct line between the human and the non-human is sort of embedded in that question too, and that trauma can blur that line profoundly, right? That the prefrontal, you know, cerebral cortex, this idea where our reason sits, our supposedly most elevated, higher conscious self, you know, is not in charge in a post-traumatic state. So
it's ever in charge.
Yeah.
Like to think.
Right. That's its own set of mythologies. But this idea that and I don't even like using the word primal in opposition to that, but there is this way that, you know, other parts of brain function become activated and lose all track of differentiation between what's really happening and what's imagined, the present and the past blur completely. You know, that if you've been traumatized to the point where you actually don't know what it's like to experience safety, everything feels unsafe to you, no matter how many people tell you you're safe, because you don't know how to recognize a safe environment. So, you know, our set of reasoning skills is not entirely functional in those states. And so to write from that place, I'm thinking about people who write also from the point of view of very, very young children, or the point of view of people on the spectrum, on the autism spectrum, are also, I think, trying to address those blurry zones around how you write about things that are in many ways unspeakable.
And I just, yeah, the trauma itself, of course, scientists know, and we know now, that it changes, especially at a young age, it permanently changes your brain. That idea of safety does, and flight is, and emergencies are altered forever, and so you might change, and yet you don't change in some ways. Your initial reactions are going to be different, because your brain actually looks different from other people who might not have had to have those kind of flight reactions that that one might have developed as a trauma victim. So one place is memoirs, of course, but the problem with that, of course, it's one, a very close friend of mine who has come under great attack in the last couple of years, is that if you're going to tell a story and you are a trauma victim, but you don't know how to even understand, you're not able to see your own story in a way, and you're not in some ways able to see a chronology or cause and effect, as well as sometimes you don't even know what really happened anymore. He's been attacked unfairly. I think it's very sad, because he's unable to defend himself, because he's actually Shin Dong-hyuk. He's actually the most traumatized of North Korean camp survivors that we have on record today.
Yeah.
You're writing about, you're depicting trauma and displacement, and survival is also obviously part of that. Where do you get inspiration for showing survivor characters who are authentic and complex?
Even my first book was about survivors. I mean, they're all different, and they might not look like it, but that's something that I'm always going to carry with me. know, first because of the life that I lived when I was young and grew up, in some ways trying to get by, trying to get out, and the people that I was attracted to as well. You know, my closest Italian friend from university, you know, she grew up without running water, and her father died on the streets, an alcoholic. They went hungry, and this is in Italy. You know, this is in near Milano, somewhere you think you're going to be okay, and she wasn't. So that that wasn't something I need to look for. Material finds you as a writer. I think if you're really, you know, if you're not trying to write for a market, and you're not trying to write to spin the latest theme, but you're really writing because you need and want to write, it doesn't matter what you want to write. You will write what you need to write, I think. Because the books that I try to write that I think, oh, this is an interesting idea, I really like it, and I should know more about this, it's something that will not continue. But I end up coming back to those survivors because it's something I really care about intimately, and I understand in some ways. So even my third book, I finally started to understand this book has an insane number of characters' point of views and worlds, but I started to understand one of my characters when I realized, oh, when she's alone, she goes into the closet and she sleeps there, and she doesn't use her room because she feels safe. There's the ceiling is low, there's no space, and no one can get her in there. There's, you know, you have a back, and there's nothing behind you. So that's just more instinct for me, where I go to what I understand.
I was thinking all the way back to the passage that you read and the way you're so deft with your characterization, even of characters who really appear very briefly on the page, and the guy who's taking her across, the way his leg swings out when he walks, and chewing on his bottom lip, and just, you know, the small details actually are the key often to bringing characters to life, and just the one or two right ones, the really distinctive ones, are what make these characters feel real. And so, you know, a detail like her choosing to sleep in the closet, it tells us a lot about her in ways that, you know, we don't need to know what she has for breakfast so much anymore.
And then unfortunately, once, you know, one writes something like that, it ends up telling you a lot about yourself as well. Like, oh, I understand her better.
And do you sleep
better
in a closet?
I'm like, I understand her better because she feels really safe in a closet with nothing behind her. I'm like, okay, I don't know if I... And that's the other thing about writing, is that you discover so much about yourself when you write. And it's not necessarily, maybe it's a bit of a shock, you know, to finish a story and think, so that's how I see or understand the world. I mean, but that's also the gift of writing too, as well. But the details that finds when you're writing a character, or how you discover a character, again, I think of it as like life. When you meet people, we hopefully, you know, I try not to make a judgment about a person because I know nothing about someone when I first meet them. All you see is this facade, and to assume something about a person because of, you know, what they look like or what race they are or one thing they say on maybe a very off day, they probably hadn't slept for 48 hours, you know nothing. And then, you know, then over months or years when you know someone, your feeling about them and who they are changes and shifts and complicates over time. And it's like light, you know, the light moves all day long and everything looks different as the light moves. That's what it's like for me writing characters, I think I know who these characters are at the beginning, and over the process of writing a novel, I realized that I didn't know anything about them all at the beginning, and I'm getting to know them. And over the years it takes to finish a novel, the struggle to understand your characters, for me, very much resembles the struggle to understand the human beings, you know, the people in my life.
Mm-hmm. Other questions out there? Ah, over there.
Right there. Chris. Thanks for joining us today. Something that really struck me was, if I'm interpreting correctly, I sense, and I'm excited to read your work, but you honor sort of the complexity of trauma in terms of, I don't know, good and bad, and that people, we pass trauma along and we do things to survive. And I'm just wondering, in a literary sense, how you give that authenticity and complexity to something that, you know, people pass on trauma, but you're writing a protagonist type character. And if good and bad ever comes into your mind when you're developing your characters, or if it's honesty, or basically, yeah, I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah. It's a great expression to pass on trauma. It's what families do to each other. It's also the relationship often between a nation or a culture and a group of people. I think the Native American culture in America, as well as the Native cultures in the Aboriginals in Australia as well. The way that trauma has decisively shaped the self is something you can't escape. But in terms of writing, I don't think of good and bad so much as when I write, but the expression that you, I think you used just after the good and bad, this idea of trying to get to the whole self, or that the truth. The truth of the moment and the truth of the character is what I try to find in the writing. And so when and there's so many false notes in my work, and each time I finish a book, I feel like I have failed. You know, but that's, you know, the hope is the next book you're like, you know, fail less or fail better. But the more of those true notes that I have in a book, the happier I feel with what's happening on the page. But that true note is what is, again, so complicated in life, somehow being reflected in fiction. And that is both the good and bad, you know, the vain and the sweet, and the, you know, the that which is insidious, and the things that people, one doesn't even want to admit about oneself, that's on the page. We're all these things, and what I think fiction does is dramatize it or highlight it or make us, for one still moment, notice it. Life happens so quickly. Sometimes you think of what happens in one day, and it's nothing dramatic has to happen, and yet it's overwhelming if you really think about a day or a week. And even an interaction at the kitchen table or a picnic, you know, group of people, infinitely complex dynamics and desires and this push and pull that happens in so many subtle ways. But you can't stop. You can't say, let me press the pause button and think about my answer before I respond to what happened. You know, something physical, something physical happens to you when people say something or look at you a certain way, or, you know, dynamics are so complicated. The great thing about fiction is you have that pause button. You can go back and reread that sentence again and again, or think about it, step back a moment, and let yourself try to understand that moment. And so for me, fiction is doing the thing that I'm not able to do in life, and somehow try to feel, experience that complexity in the writing, and then to read. You know, I'm a reader before I'm a writer, and to read for that complexity. I'm not satisfied with books that give me simple, easy answers, or try to give me beautiful language and tell me life is really much better than you think. It's okay. And I don't want the false answer. I already have, like, bad television shows or reality TV or, you know, action movies with action, you know, action figure heroes for that. I go to books for that thing, that complicated truth.
That refers us all the way back to the first question, too, of, you know, why fiction? And that slowing down, that level of precision, and, you know, talking about trauma, which can be so global, but in a really, really particular way. How's our, are we running out of time? Is that what's happening? Or you have to go? Do you all have to go? Okay. So this idea, I'm thinking about, you know, piggybacking on that question too, the way that hunger is very, very particular in this book. It's super literal. It's also beautifully metaphoric. And that too is a way of addressing this human, less than human experience. It's the way of locating trauma in the body in this way that, you know, a child who has experienced starvation is always going to have a particular relationship to food. Do you want to say something about hunger on our way out?
You know, we start life hungry. I mean, you know, out of the womb and, you know, into the world, and deprived suddenly of the safe place in the body, and you're exposed to these lights and these strangers. Yeah, hunger is this primordial drive that I'm really interested in, and the hunger for the fundamental things, safety, in this book, but also in the novel, the hunger for love, the hunger for community, the hunger for belonging, the hunger for someone to understand you. And in my novel as well, there's not just the desire for a safety, but I think a desire for the people that share your experience, a community, whether it's loosely formed or it changes, it breaks up and comes back again. All those hungers are really interesting to me. It seems so fundamental to life, on both the literal and the metaphorical level. But on the other hand, Buddhism is in the last couple of years has become something I'm thinking a lot about and also reading about and experiencing again in Korea, because the move towards stripping oneself of hunger to let go and to become a kind of, I mean, a metaphorical stone. I refer to that in my first book, a poem about a woman who's suffering with, her husband is just a flamboyant serial artist who thinks the artist is a green card that lets you do anything you want to. And she imagines herself a stone. She borrows it from a poem where you don't feel or think anything. Things just pass and wash over you. So I'm also becoming very interested in the thing, the counterpoint to hunger, that the letting go of hunger.
Thank you for nourishing us today. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the 2017 Bay Area Book Festival. For more podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.